Kids Comics.
And here are your hosts, Michael and Andrew Leyland.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome back to Hey Kids Comics, Treasury Edition. Why should we not call it that?
Is this episode of Treasury?
It is a limited collector's edition.
You could have released it as a facsimile and just re-release an old episode.
Oh, don't think I haven't done that in the past. I don't think I've not considered it for the upcoming summer of Superman.
Right.
Now, we will be doing a new episode for this.
Okay.
And we have talked about what it's going to be.
Yeah.
More on that later. But I have been listening back to Happy Birthday Superman, mm-hmm. which is what we did for Superman's 75th birthday. Do you remember this?
I know we did it.
Okay. We did eight.
Yeah.
Eight episodes.
Yeah.
Which at that time was two whole months.
Yeah.
Of content. and my God, that's thorough. I'm actually very proud of it.
We used to put effort into this.
We did. What do you mean we don't put effort in yet? But it's really good. And I heartily endorse you. Go and check it out. They're all on archive. The link's at the end of the show because I've put it in the end bit. So people know where it is.
I mean, I can remember the odd story that we did.
Mm. Red Care?
The one with the asteroid and he loses his powers.
Yes.
That's it?
Yeah. No, you remember the secret of Red Care?
Which one's that?
The one where he discovers what red kryptonite is. You don't remember that one at all?
No.
The first meeting of Superman and Batman on the boat?
Oh yeah, I know that. But
Lois Lane ends up being all cougary with Robin.
I remember that mostly because it got rewritten in Superman Batman.
Yeah, Joe Kelly did.
Yeah.
With Deadpool in it, but he couldn't call him Deadpool.
Yeah.
Because we covered that as well.
We
did a little bit. And we did 70s, 80s, and then we ended it with What's So Funny About Truth, Justice, and the American World.
Which, yeah.
And we eviscerate.
No, I remember that. But we did do the one where Batman plays a prank on him.
Which is
quite possibly my favourite.
The Super Keita Fort Superman?
That's the one. That's probably my favourite Superman story.
No. But fortunately, lovely listener, it exists as a time capsule. And you can go back and listen to them. And I heartily endorse you do. But the point of this, and I do have a point,
right,
was I was going to re-edit them, recut them,
and
re-release edited
highlights. Re-release.
Yeah.
Well, some kind of like omnibus.
No.
You can just watch on UK Podcast Gold, which I'm sure is a thing.
That is not a bad idea though, but it would be about 8 hours long.
Right.
And nobody's got time for that.
No.
But I was going to re-edit them.
Like, it's a big thing on YouTube for people to watch 5-10 hour videos of just a 90 minute film.
Don't think I haven't already thought of putting us on YouTube.
Right.
If we have the little camera there. And we just film us both.
You say this every time, and every time I say no.
Yeah.
Hey Kids Uncensored.
Yeah, you're very negative on the idea, I think it's fair to say. And I'm not. I think it's a great idea, as long as it brings in some of that filthy lucre.
Okay, right.
But anyway, I say all that to say this. I had considered re-editing them and putting them out there as edited highlights.
Okay, that requires
an awful lot of effort. Yeah. And I think I ultimately came down on the side of, they're all out there, go and listen to them. They're good. Anyway,
I'm not very old now.
Today we're at the limited collector's edition.
Yeah.
We're covering the limited collector's editions, facsimile editions. This was your idea.
Was it?
Yes.
Oh, I will take credit.
Well, I should hope so, because it was your idea. Before we delve into these lovely limited facsimiles, we do have an email or two. We'll cover one at the beginning and one at the end, because that's what we do now. The email at the beginning is from Michael Baylor. Hey, Mike.
Hey, yo.
Andy and Michael, I will admit part of my enjoyment of this episode, he's talking about the Ultimate Spider-Man episode, which was two episodes back, as we record this, something like that. It calls back to my favourite episodes of the original show. I love it that we've now got an original show. We're like Star Trek. We've got the original show, and then we've got the sequels of varying quality.
Yes.
Oh, God, I hope we're not Voyager. Your Spider-Man episodes were among some of the best back then, and even though Andy has a Spider-Man show going, I do, Amazing Spider-Man, from the very beginning, worth checking out, it's nice to hear you both talking about the wall crawler. This one really took me back. Ultimate Spider-Man and the Ultimate Universe was a huge deal when it premiered. I remember being put off a little by Bendis' interviews, but he seemed really snarky about the whole thing. He banged on how about they're going to be different and not have all this continuity, and while I did not have the mindset of looking at things as critically then as I do now, I do remember thinking, and telling people at the comic shop, Titans at the time, that's all well and good to be proud of not having the baggage of continuity, but what happens in 10 years?
Yeah, which is what happened.
It was a very prescient question, wasn't it? The answer is they basically blew up the Ultimate Universe, although it only took them 8 years. It's also worth noting that the Spider-Man titles weren't doing well at the time the Ultimate version hit the stands, and there was a feeling at the time that Ultimate Spider-Man was the good Spider-Man book, and the regular titles were crap. Then Jenkins took over Peter Parker Spider-Man and JMS came on Amazing Spider-Man. Suddenly the Spider-Man titles were good again. I guess it's the strength of both Bendis' writing and Spider-Man becoming a blockbuster film and thus becoming a thing, as opposed to becoming the thing, that the character could sustain two different versions on the stands and at bookstores. And that opened up a whole can of worms, didn't it? That the character can sustain two different versions.
And then it sustains three and four and five.
How many are there now?
Yeah.
And not just Spider-Man. Across the board. Anyway, I'm rambling, which I know will come as a huge surprise to both of you, so I'll end it here. Loved hearing Michael's genuine affection for the books, and it was his perspective that I was most looking forward to. Well, thanks, Mike. Returning to the comics that made you can be perilous. I'm glad it went well for you. There you go.
Yeah.
Your friend, Mikey might be. Well, thank you, Michael. We very much appreciate that. Yeah, we enjoyed that one, didn't we? We've talked about going back to the Ultimate Universe at some point.
Yes. I think it's a case of it can always go well when you revisit those comics as long as you know when to stop.
Yes. So would you stop before Bendis rebooted it or before Bendis completely stopped
it and
went to Miles Morales?
I don't know. Carry on, because they've just, in the new solicitations as of this month, have announced that the Death of Spider-Man omnibus is getting repackaged and re-released as just the Ultimate Spider-Man omnibus volume 5.
Yeah.
So it's, do you stop with Bagley leaving? Do you stop when the main title ends and gets rebooted? Do you? Because,
or do you just stick with it because it does actually end now?
Because from what I remember is it doesn't end.
Does it not? Does it just become Miles?
Because Peter, that it gets retconned that the whole thing took place in 3 years and Peter dies and Miles takes over, but then Peter comes back and then Miles moves to the regular universe.
See, my memory is I got as far as, spoilers, Gwen being killed and then brought back. And I think that was my, really?
Well, you didn't.
Did I not get that far?
No, you got further.
Oh, did I?
Twice as far.
Right, okay, carry
so,
on.
So,
you remember this better than I do.
She dies and comes back in what you have as hardbacks.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
She gets killed before Ultimate Omnibus 3. See, I haven't reread these.
She gets killed in my Omnibus Volume 2.
Right, okay.
She comes back in what will be Omnibus Volume 3.
Right. See, I've not read this far.
Because Volume 4 of the Omnibuses is when Bagley leaves. So, yeah. So, Volume 3, I think, is when she comes back, because that's when they do the Clone Saga.
Right.
You carried on picking up the issues well into Stuart Immonen taking over.
See, in my memory, she only comes back in Stuart Immonen.
No.
Isn't that weird, that?
No, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. All right, fair enough. I will go with you, though, because I can't contradict you, because I just don't remember.
I hope so, because I am right.
That seems fair enough. All right. One of the great joys of the modern comics landscape, and we've banged on about this before,
it's old comics.
Is old comics. Yeah, it has been the advent of the facsimile edition. As close as possible to the originals as you can get, these facsimiles republish in their entirety an old comic book as it was originally seen, complete with adverts, house ads, and letters pages. For the first time, you could own Amazing Spider-Man number one, Daredevil number one, Fantastic Four number one, almost exactly as they were originally presented in the 1960s. And then DC got in on the act because they saw there was filthy lucre to be made.
And were Marvel first?
I think Marvel were first in this
okay,
one. Yeah.
Okay.
Obviously, I'd stand to be corrected.
Mm-hmm.
But then they did facsimile editions of Superman 1, Batman number 1, other famous first appearances on notable editions. And I had a conversation with the aforementioned Mike Bailey.
Okay.
When we were in Florida, they just started becoming a thing because I bought the holy grail of comic books, the facsimile of Amazing Spider-Man number 129.
Okay.
And I published a picture on social media of your mum reading it by the pool.
Yeah.
And a couple of people genuinely had a heart attack thinking that it was a real 129 and not the facsimile.
Yeah, so Michael Bailey was the reason for your addiction to this.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, I've said this before. He bought so many things in this comic that he got a free card.
Okay.
For a couple of free comics, and you said, well, I'm never coming back here, Andy, you have it.
Right.
And I went, I will take this opportunity and run with it. And I picked up loads of facsimile editions, and that's where I fell in love with them. And I mused with Michael in a conversation while we were there, do you think like a full-on reprint of a series would sustain itself? And the suggestion I threw out, though, was Tomb of Dracula.
Right.
A popular cult series, got a devoted fan following, and it ends. Mm. 75 issues.
Yeah.
And various annuals and stuff like that, but it has a definitive ending.
Okay.
And that came true. They've not gone quite that far, but they've done a full run of Secret Wars.
Yeah.
Full run of Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yes.
12 issues of the Fantastic Four they're doing, so they can do them.
And they've the black costume.
Black costume Spider-Man. They are filling in the gaps on the Dark Phoenix saga.
Yeah.
So they can do Treasury Edition, collected editions of facsimile. And that's where they lose me.
Yeah.
Because I'm a little bit confused about that. The joy of a facsimile edition...
is that it is the issue.
Is that it's the issue, yeah. And Crisis was an especially a joy.
Yeah.
Because I didn't get to read that as it came out in 1985. I only read that when it became a trade paperback. So experiencing it month by month as it was meant to be read...
yeah.
...was really a joy. And it regularly became the first comic from my new pile that I read.
But I think the 12...
yeah.
...that is as long as I think it could go.
Yeah.
I don't think it could sustain... a long-running series. I think minis or maxi or whatever it is. I think 12 is that kind of sweet spot.
Well, that seems to be... they're doing the first Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
First 12.
Yeah.
The Dark Phoenix is, what, 8 or 9 issues? But a couple of them are double-sized.
Yeah.
And they'll probably throw Days of Future Past in there as well, I would have thought.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever. Because they've done them already. They've done facsimiles of them.
Right.
Already. You suggested this, you don't remember it. What's the appeal of facsimiles for you, though?
Well, there wasn't.
All right.
I didn't get it. I didn't see the big deal. For me, why would you want to just buy the issue? Like, just get it in a trade. Just read it in that. Like, everything that they publish is a facsimile, you can just get somewhere else. So I didn't get it. Until this. And I think it was last summer, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The Demon Treasury. And I think I grabbed this because there was just something about it that I was just in the mood for just sitting in the garden with this big old magazine size comic, and just I was in the mood for like an old comic, and it was kind of that when I was like, all right, okay, and I'm seeing what the solicitor and what kind of issues are, and I think they were kind of hitting that sweet spot that I think they've lost now. The more popular they've gotten, is it was just iconic, important single issues. So and as much as I complain about how much they cost, some of the old magazine ones were, you've got like your old war comics where they're really quite thick, and you have the issue with Detective Comics, which has got all your kind of backups. It's just they're really just kind of nice, and they kind of scratch that itch compared to, say, modern comics, which I think are a bit more disposable. I don't like the term, but yeah. So going back and reading these old ones, it's like, oh, these are really nice, and I feel like I'm actually reading something, and it's just kind of something about the vibe of them is just kind of nice. I think the issue now, though, is they're losing that, because as I noticed from reading the recent Swamp Thing one that they did, its big selling point was it's the first appearance of John Constantine, but it's part one of an ongoing story arc, so it feels wrong to just be reading that one issue.
We've both discussed that they are starting to go to that well a little bit too much now.
And especially when they've just solicited comics that came out in the last 10 years.
Yeah, they're doing all of Hush's facsimile editions. Yeah.
Part of the joy of these facsimiles is you're reading comics from 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. Mm. Like, going back towards the very beginnings of the Golden Age, you can buy Hush.
Yes,
I'm sure.
Readily available.
I'm sure for an inflated price, you can buy back issues of Hush. You can buy the issue of Detective Comics that's got the Joker cover.
Yeah.
You can buy all of these for a fraction of the price that you can buy a copy of Amazing Fantasy 15 for. Mm. But you can buy the facsimile of Amazing Fantasy 15 for cover price.
Well,
yeah.
That's a sticking point with me.
So I feel like doing comics that were released in the last 15, 20 years undermines the joy of a facsimile.
It does a little bit, but you've also got the thing, though, that, well, we just don't buy them.
Yeah, that's...
which
that's,
I don't. I'm not buying reprints of Hush. I've got Hush.
Yeah.
I don't need the reprint.
And then you get to the other issue, and they've started doing this with the Treasuries now as well. I think they've just announced it for the second or the third one. Foil covers, variant covers, sketch covers, because then they're not a facsimile.
That's not a facsimile,
That's another way for slabbers and resellers to make money on what should just be a cheap way to read the original comic.
And don't get me started on the slabbers of facsimile editions.
Yeah.
Like, that you just mentioned Amazing Fantasy 15, though.
Yeah.
I didn't buy Amazing Fantasy 15
right
when it came out as a facsimile.
Yeah.
And there are literally people who've got that slabbed for 100 quid.
Yeah.
And I just want to take them outside and smack them about the first little
and
bit.
And it just, I think, I didn't get it when it came out, but I was looking the other day, maybe picking up Detective 400, the Man Bat one.
Yeah, I've got that one.
And I thought, well, they might pick it up because, you know, they probably...
It's got, nice, it's got the original colour in it.
Yeah.
That's why it's worth having those.
Right.
That's worth mentioning as well.
Okay.
For the people that don't like that Neil Adams had his recoloured, had his work completely recoloured for the omnibuses
right.
and subsequent trades, the originals, the facsimile editions are not recoloured.
Right. They are facsimile.
Yeah.
But I think I couldn't find it for anywhere less than £10, which I already think £10 is already far too much for a comic. And yeah, there's
especially a reprint.
The slab in them and all this, and it's what kind of black soul do you have to take a reprint that the sole intention of that reprint was to give modern audiences as close as possible mm-hmm. to picking up that original issue and then thinking, well, I'm going to make it so A, they can't read it mm-hmm. and B, they have to pay an extortionate amount for the privilege of not being able to read it.
Couldn't agree more. I'm 100% with you. I think DC's facsimiles overall are better than Marvel's.
Paper quality.
Yeah, I think the paper stock in the DC ones is much more authentic to the time.
Yeah.
But also, it's got that rough...
The feel of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Not quite newsprint.
No, and Marvel's a glossy.
Yeah.
Which you're reading... I've stopped buying the Fantastic Four facsimiles.
Right.
I only bought like the first three.
Okay.
Because the paper stock's like... No. I'm going to get the three that reprint the Galactus
saga. I think I've ordered them, yeah.
I'm getting them. Because that's at the peak of Marvel's powers.
Right.
So you'll have the bullpen bulletins and the letters pages and that era of house ads where Marvel was really, you know, the little engine that could.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get them, but I stopped buying the facsimiles with issue 4 of Fantastic Four. And I think the only one of them I would buy is if they do it with Spider-Man.
Okay, yeah.
I think they're the only ones I'd really get because, you know, I'm in the pocket of Big Spider.
I'm getting them as well because most recently Godzilla versus the Fantastic Four, which came out last month, is a direct sequel to Fantastic Four 50.
Is it? All right, okay. Well, I'm sure we're going to be covering that.
But speaking of adverts, there is a joy to them, and it's the same joy that I feel when I'm reading, like, 90s Vertigo titles, that kind of recognising that same kind of era of comics, of adverts.
It's interesting, just for a second, they've not done any Vertigo facsimiles.
Well, there was going to be one, but then certain things...
Oh, yeah, they were going to do issue 8 of Sandman, weren't they?
Yeah, and then... But I think I messaged you, like, there's one that I love. It's the Reese's, the little Reese's alien guy. Love that dude. Like, there's just...
That's Secret Wars.
Well, he's in Crisis.
Yes. Well, so, it was the same ads, wasn't it?
Yeah. And so just recognising those ads, and then the page that you would get that was just littered with... Tat adverts, like call this number for that kind of stuff. Nothing even remotely compares nowadays.
They don't have ads anymore. That's why they're so expensive.
Yeah.
There's no advertising revenue in comic books, which is a shame. That for the most part, they've been great. DC have been reprinting the Treasure Editions. DC stepped up the game, though.
Yeah.
It wasn't just the facsimiles. They were doing facsimiles of Treasury Editions or limited collector's editions.
And this is where I think the gold
is. I again couldn't agree with you more, which is why we're doing this show. There's been some minor niggles. We'll talk about those niggles,
but I think the minor niggles for me are to do with the treasuries themselves in the first place, not necessarily the facsimiles.
Right. Yeah. Well, this one is, which we'll mention in a minute. For those that don't know, the Treasury Edition, because there may be some people listening going, what the hell's a Treasury Edition? Was a much larger size of comic. It was 10 inches by 14 inches. There were staples of the reprint game in the 70s. Marvel, DC both did these oversized comics.
And they're a bit more square bound, aren't they?
Yeah. I would see adverts for them in Marvel UK comics and salivate over them.
Right.
Because I never saw them. These were all in Grandad Peter's comics.
Okay. Yeah.
Before I was reading them. So these were in my dad's comics before I was.
Right. Okay. Because weren't our American comics British versions of American comics?
Yeah, they had British print stickers on them.
Yeah.
And there are certain fans who hate it when you point out that actually the British price ones were printed first.
Right,
because that got the print run going.
Right.
This is a rumour.
Okay,
I don't know if this is true. But so the Sense versions are reprint. Just putting that out there to upset whoever it upsets. If you're unaware of the Treasury Edition, though, I need you to hove on over to the Fire and Water Podcast Network and listen to Treasury Cast.
Right.
A lovely celebration of the format by Rob Kelly. And I'm not just saying that because he had me on a couple of times. No, it's great. 100 episodes, and he did it perfectly.
Are there that many treasuries?
Oh, yeah, and he didn't cover them all.
Right, okay.
He did 100 episodes and called it a day.
Right.
Prior to that, he had Treasury.com.
Okay.
Which is what really got me back into these. In the early days of eBay,
yeah, yeah.
You remember this, some of the first things I bought were Treasury Editions.
Right, okay.
I would bring the laptop home from work. Do you remember this? Yeah. Big, massive laptop from work. I'd plug it into the phone socket.
Right.
And I bought...
This is going back a bit.
I bought Superman, Spider-Man.
Right.
One okay. and two, the Treasury then. I think I bought Batman, Hulk.
So it's mental, isn't it, to think that eBay was this revolutionary thing that could bridge that gap.
Yeah, and now, like, it's been corporatized and it's shit.
The adverts that were like a distant dream when you were a kid were bridged by eBay.
You could make them give it form.
Yeah.
And I bought loads of Treasury Editions. And really, you look back at it now and you go, literally just before, they skyrocketed in price.
Because that gap was bridged.
Yeah, right. And also you've got the thing that it becomes rarer.
Mm.
To get a Treasury Edition in mint condition was very, very difficult because they're a yeah. bitch to store.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is something fans moan about a lot as well. It's appropriate that the facsimile should embrace the Treasury format because the original Treasuries, as dreamt up by DC staff member Sol Harrison, were facsimile reprints of DC's original Golden Age lineup. So he tested the waters with the first Treasury, which was Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
There was Santa, wasn't there religious yeah. ones as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, yeah, there was a Bible one and a Santa Claus one. The Rudolph one was in 72.
Okay.
It was successful, so he produced editions of Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Captain Marvel,
yeah.
all called Famous First Editions.
That's insane when you think about it from any point of view that to test the longevity of a new format of comics, you go for Rudolph yeah. and Santa. That's insane. Yeah. That is a gamble that I'm surprised paid off.
But it did. And these books were exact reproductions down to the original advertising,
mm-hmm.
but in Treasury size.
Right,
so
okay.
we've come... Full circle. It's like poetry. It rhymes. Did you ever read any of my Treasuries?
Superman, Spider-Man.
Because we covered that
probably.
On the show.
I think I read it.
Oh, I've got
it.
A
I think,
picture
I think
of you
I read
reading
it.
That.
Anyway,
yeah.
I think possibly that's the only one that yeah. I remember anyway. But it was this one that was just like...
This one being limited collector's edition C51.
Yeah.
A.K.A. The Ra's al Ghul Saga by Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams.
And it's this one that, regardless of anything else...
Nope.
It just so happened to be a good story with great art. Regardless of anything else...
But you already love these stories.
But I think the format makes it the equivalent of a summer blockbuster.
Yeah. And especially these stories.
There's no greater joy than having such an oversized mm-hmm. way to immerse yourself in the artwork.
Yeah.
So ever since this, it became almost... Considering I was somewhat against facsimile editions, I now panic when I go without one of these. I think there's a couple that I missed and you had to track down or whatever. So
I had to find Superman Wonder Woman for you.
Because it was never solicited.
Yeah, we
it
did not get
out.
A solicitation. I literally went into Forbidden Planet in Liverpool.
Yeah.
And it was duh.
Yeah.
And then, can I just say as well, look, as much of a pain in the ass as that was... To walk into a comic book store and see a Treasury
yeah, yeah.
on the shelf that you didn't know was going to be there.
Yeah.
Because I think we knew it had been announced.
But not.
But for yeah. whatever reason, where we get our comics from,
didn't
solicit it. So neither of us had ordered it.
Yeah.
And I walked into Forbidden Planet and it was... Oh! It's like... Literally a new Treasury Edition on the stand. Yeah. I didn't know. Whoa, I'm having that.
But I get so stressed out because sometimes they're listed by the name of the story.
Yes.
Sometimes
it's... The amount of times you've texted me and said, have I ordered
C51? Because that's it. I don't... C51. I don't know who they are.
But in your defence, C51 is that tiny...
Yeah.
...little number there in the price circle.
So the panic sweat pouring... Of just like, I can't miss out on this one. Oh, but I'll have to buy it for double the price. Oh, no. So, yeah, now I own all of these.
Yes.
And I will continue to own all of them. They yeah. can reprint the Rudolph one and I will buy it.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Because I've got this.
Yeah.
I've
yeah.
got the original of this. This was one of the ones I bought in the early days and the covers come off.
Right.
Because that's a notorious thing with the Treasuries, the staples.
Because of
the... Yeah.
Well, was... So these new ones, these facsimiles, have a thick cardstock
yes.
cover, which is smaller than the comic itself.
Yeah,
weirdly.
So you can see the top of the comic,
yeah.
which is very weird.
The originals, were they paper covers or card?
The more like the glossy covers you got on comics of the time.
Right, so these thick card covers are new to this.
Yes, it's not quite facsimile.
Yeah.
But I forgive them for the cover.
Yeah.
One of the niggles that I mentioned earlier on that I am going to talk about is this has a wraparound Neil Adams cover, which is just a stunning piece of art. Batman crying over Robin's dead body. Talia al Ghul's in the background looking all slinky and sexy, and Ra's is like Dracula. Which is interesting because they wanted Christopher Lee. They modelled this on Christopher Lee.
Right, okay.
The niggle, though, they've reproduced the cover slightly wrong.
It's reformatted.
It's been raised, meaning we see more of the bottom. On the original, you don't see Robin's fingers. It cuts off under Neil Adams' signature. So you've seen a lot more at the bottom, though, than you did. The upshot of this is that the Batman logo is now covering Ra's face.
Okay.
Which on the original it isn't. And also, what's that mistake though?
Yeah, I didn't notice that earlier. Well, this
Robin's R on his red breast has been duplicated.
Doubled.
Yeah.
Well, I did notice as well, this colouring looks very modernised. Is this a recolour or is this actually what it looks like?
I think the cover's been recoloured.
Right.
Which is...
They've just not stated that.
Yeah, I don't know what I think about that.
Mm.
On the one hand, I'm not against the fact the foil covers. Loads of people love the foil covers.
Okay.
And I don't mind the foil covers being there as long as I can buy the original. I'm not going to buy the foil covers.
Okay.
But I'm not going to piss all over somebody who loves them.
Okay.
And if you've already got these, but you're buying them for the foil cover, so at least you can justify in your head, well, there's a difference.
Yeah.
That's fine. That's perfectly okay.
Only comics can you use a minor difference to justify buying the same thing
over and over and over again. But so that's fine. I personally am not a fan of the foil covers, but if you love them, fair play to you. When they alter it like this cover has done, I'm a little bit less likely to be as magnanimous.
Because
the foil cover I can ignore. I don't want to buy it. It's there for the people that do. But they've futzed around with the cover.
The standard cover, yeah.
And they should have just left it alone.
Mm.
But, you know, whatever. Anyway, this week reprints Batman 232 from June 1971. And the three-part story that follows this up from Batman 242 through 244. The storyline that introduces Ra's al Ghul and his delectable daughter, Talia. Daughter of the Demon is one of my all-time favourite Batman stories. And I love...
I bought the facsimile for that as well with this. Yes. So I read that first.
So you've got the facsimile for that and the treasure.
I bought them together so I could read them together.
My favourite bit to this is Batman in the Himalayas.
Yeah.
With Ra's, because goddamn that feels like on Her Majesty's Secret Service, doesn't
it? It's Batman does Bond.
Yeah. And it's beautiful in the treasure. And like we say, if you're one of those people that does not like the recolouring, this does not recolour them.
Yeah.
This is the colouring as it was originally meant to be seen. And it's this... I could just throw superlatives at this.
It's just the larger size.
Yeah.
And it sold me on Neil Adams' artwork that never has done before. So maybe controversially somewhat, there was something about Neil Adams' artwork that was a bit off to me, and I could never work out what it was. And I saw it on a large scale, and I realised Neil Adams utilises background, midground and foreground a lot more than a lot of other comic artists do. Mm. The good example that springs to mind is when he came back to do Batman Odyssey, is it?
Yes.
There's a cover of Batman reaching forward and there's like bullets going through his hand.
Mm.
Neil Adams, as I realise reading these big oversized treasuries, is the comic book equivalent of that period of time when every single movie had a 3D version.
Yes.
And seeing that, it's like, oh yeah, all of this clicks into place now. And I suddenly started to appreciate Neil Adams more because of the larger size. Mm-hmm. I thought, he's an artist who was... His art is designed to be read like this. I think reading Neil Adams' comic art in comic size just completely does him a disservice. Yeah, so these oversized treasuries was like, oh my god, I get Neil Adams now.
I've always liked Neil Adams, but yeah, seeing it like this, and we'll get back to Neil in treasury format
because he's done three out of he's done, six
well like you say it makes his artwork pop,
yeah,
arguably more than anybody else. There are some that we'll talk about, that the treasury format does them no favours.
No. Which makes me wonder why they were chosen in the first place.
Yes. But yeah, I cannot recommend the limited collector's edition C51 enough.
Yeah.
If you ignore that cover, and a lot of people can't.
Really?
Yeah.
It strikes me as one of those things, with them being aimed at modern audiences, that you just kind of look over. But,
no.
Right, okay.
But the interior, the interior is just gorgeous. I just love the interior. Marvel Comics took note and started producing their own treasury in 1974. DC combated this by initially adding extra material, so they weren't all just reprints. Case in point, limited collector's edition C37. And again, this one is black on purple.
Yeah.
So it's quite easy to go, C37, what the hell does that mean? What does it mean?
Is it the just the number of when it was released?
I don't know, because they didn't release 37 treasuries like this, did they?
Well, they did do a lot.
But the next one is C56.
I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know. If you know what C whatever represents, you know, get in touch. If it was mentioned on Treasury Cast, I've forgotten.
Are there any ads in the Demon one? Because there are ads in some of the other ones, because what's quite cool is some of the ads will be for other treasuries.
The only ad in the Demon one is for Superman,
right,
Muhammad
yeah,
Ali.
Yeah.
And Superman Wonder Woman.
Right.
So at the time that they printed this,
yeah,
they must have been aware that they were going to reprint them as well.
Okay, yeah.
I'd have to dig out my original and see what the adverts were in that, and I would have done that if we were professional.
Because it is kind of cool, because it makes them all feel like their own little mini-series.
Yes, yes it does. This one reprints stories, The Cross-Country Crimes from Batman number 8, The Blackbird of Banditry from Batman number 43, arguably the most interesting reprint here, The State versus Lucky Sheldon, a reprint of the Batman and Robin Sunday comic strip, originally published from June 23rd, 1946 through August 18th, 1946, strips number 138 through 146, The Scarecrow from World's Finest number 3, and The Lady Rogues from Batman 45. But the added value comes in, as Michael just mentioned, the extras. There's a tabletop diorama where you can make a 3D version of the cover. I mean, you've got to cut the cover up.
The cover up. Dana keeps threatening to do that.
Why?
Because it winds me up.
Oh, right. Okay. Why did you not buy two?
What, just to let her do that?
Yeah. So, and then you can sit back and read it. And go,
there's another one. I think it's the Flash and Superman one that comes with another diorama. Yeah, so as soon as she saw it, she's like, going to cut it up. Going to cut it up.
Does come up with another diorama. Secrets of the Batcave. A double-page spread looking at the Batplane. The Batcave of 1968 should be mentioned. So we won't have much in the way of computerized technology in 1968. I wouldn't have thought.
So it's just a whole room. The computer is just the whole room.
Yeah. A whole part of the cave is the room. A look at the Batplane, Batarang and Batcuffs, which Catwoman enjoyed. the contents of Batman and Robin's utility belt, which gets updated depending on the decade. And a word search by Bob Rozakis. I can't find the word search at the minute. Is that at the back? Yes. Oh, no, the answer's at the back. Which
Batman's
is weird.
Batman's villains in the TV show.
Yeah, there's also like a Batman's villains in the TV show. The TV show's been off the air for 7 years at this point.
Right.
So it must still be doing well in syndication for them to have this. And it's interesting as well how much they would go from this to completely trying to ignore that the TV show ever existed in the 80s.
Out of embarrassment.
Yeah, like when DC goes through its teenage years. The Cross-Country Crimes has some of the oddness of the era. Gotham is apparently next door to Washington, D.C.
Right.
In this storyline. But I thought this was a cracking little Golden Age tale from Bill Finger, Bob Kane and Jerry Robinson. The Joker's nice and menacing, all machine gun fire and murderous intent. I think that splash page there of the Joker being surrounded by them. We're going to find him. All those, like those 1940s movies that you'd see. All that is absolutely brilliant.
I think this, though, as fun as the story was and as nice as it is to read it in these kind of snapshot of the era more so than anything else, is the I don't understand why this was chosen to be in the Treasury Edition in the first place, because some of Bob Kane's panel layouts and artistic choices must have looked bad as a comic size, and they look even worse on the larger size. Back on that last page, you've got this panel here.
Page 11.
Where they're going up some stairs, but the whole panel is the stairs, and Batman's tiny in the bottom.
Yeah.
And
but the whole panel's just black. The stairs are very tiny.
It's one of those, and I don't know if this is an example of what Bob Kane's artwork was like in general, or whether it's just this specific story. But yeah, it just looks
if
bad.
Bob Kane even drew this.
Yeah, it just looks bad. The Treasury does not do any favours for it.
But it's a fun story.
Yeah.
The Blackbird of Banditry by Bill Finger and Jim Mooney from 1947.
Now, this was a fun story.
This is pretty much an episode of a 60s TV show, right?
Well, yeah.
Isn't it? It's much more of a romp than the crime one.
Yeah.
So I preferred the crime one.
Right.
But, you know.
I think Batman lends himself to camp romp, so I enjoy a camp Batman romp.
Well, this was made much more fun if I just imagine Burgess Meredith doing it.
Yeah.
And suddenly this becomes, like, a lot of fun.
He's written like an English gentleman, the Penguin, in this, isn't he? I didn't realise that was a character he went through.
Yeah. The Two-Face story, I found, like I said, the most interesting part of the book.
Mm.
Because I haven't read a lot of the newspaper strips. I think I said to you, if you were in a state that didn't carry that strip, you didn't see it.
So it was limited by states, not just countries?
Yeah, there were some places that would publish certain strips and others that wouldn't.
Right.
And then again, we're a country removed.
Mm.
So if a newspaper over here didn't pick it up, we weren't reading these. So I'd never read this before. And I liked the differences. I like that in this, Two-Face is Harvey Apollo, a ham actor.
Yeah.
Not the DJ. Not the DJ. The DA. No, that's a completely different origin story.
Elseworld story.
Yeah, where he's a DJ.
Different. He has one record that's one genre, another record that's another.
Yeah. That's not quite like that. Harvey Apollo is accused of murdering a policeman. And in court, Apollo has acid thrown in his face. So it's a mixture of the comics Two-Face and Clayface, who was the actor. And it's back to being a grim crime caper more than the more, as you say, campy elements of the Blackbird of Banditry. Two-Face is hung on panel at the end of this story.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow. I wasn't expecting that.
He wasn't coming back in the newspapers,
nope.
I guess.
I think that was a bit grim. The Scarecrow was by Bill Finger, Bob Kane and Jerry Robinson. I thought this was another great one from 41. The curtailed page count hampers some of the story.
Mm.
Expediently allowing Batman to make his deductions by convenience more than logic.
Yeah.
But I found it a lovely little dark tale, and the Scarecrow is one of the better but lesser additions to the Rogues Gallery. This makes him very similar to the bookworm from the TV show. And I always...
Bookworm.
Yeah, Roddy McDowall was the bookworm.
Right, okay.
And the thing with that, right, is I always point to that episode where he said that show was always camp and stupid.
Yeah.
You take the audio...
Right.
...of Roddy McDowall as bookworm and only listen to it and don't watch it. He's scurry as sin.
Right, okay.
He's really terrifyingly insane.
Yeah.
But because it's all Dutch angles and women in skimpy costumes and Batman and Robin camping it all, it kind of lessens that. If you just listen to it.
Right, okay.
It's a brilliant performance from Roddy McDowall. So I love that one. Did you like that one?
Yeah. They were all very much of the same kind of vein for me. I think I enjoyed them more for the period of time that they represented more than I actually thought they were the particularly good, I guess.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the era more than I enjoyed the stories in and of themselves, I think.
Well, a lot of people, 13th Dimension did an article on that, and this is the best Batman Treasury they ever did.
Really?
I disagree with that, and we'll come to that why later.
Yeah.
But I think it all depends on your age.
Right.
I honestly think it depends on your age. The last story was The Lady Rogues by William Woolfolk and Charles Paris from 1948. Catwoman's annoyed that she hasn't been mentioned in a book about villainesses throughout history, so she goes about earning her spot only to learn the author was planning a book all about her.
Yeah.
Again, this is the 60s TV show.
Yeah.
So I love that what they've done in this Treasury is take two stories that can be from the 60s telly show and three stories that show the grim and gritty Batman.
Yeah.
And just basically put them all in the same Treasury edition.
When you say... depends on your age. I think that this one's like a perfect one to give to kids to get into comics. And I don't mean that in a bad way whatsoever. Like, the stories are quite thin and they're just really kind of enjoyable. They'd work well as, like, you know, Brave and the Bold cartoons, things like that.
Yeah.
This is a perfect one to just give to kids to get into comics.
Yeah, I didn't think there was a weak story in there.
No.
At all. Like you said, for the contextually, every one of those stories was fun.
Yeah.
Quite enjoyed that. Limited edition, collector's edition, C48, Superman versus The Flash,
Oh, we're doing these well out of order.
I have no idea what order I picked them in. Maybe I did them in the order.
This is keeping me on my toes.
Yeah, whatever. This is the order I did them in. We'll deal with it. It reprinted Superman's Race with the Flash from Superman 199 and its sequel, The Race to the End of the Universe, from The Flash 175. Added value this time includes a feature on the Fortress of Solitude.
But only one part of it. As Superman will say himself that it's time to get back to the second race. If I ever see you in one of these again, we'll carry on.
Oh, right. So they've trimmed it from somewhere. I like that it had Neil Adams art.
Just for that, yeah.
Just for this bit. And like you say, that splash page there is very 3D now. You've pointed it out.
Yeah.
With Superman's leg and his hand at the front and then going backwards. It also has a tabletop diorama, which you've already mentioned.
And a little how to draw the flash guide.
Which is draw the flash by Carmen Infantino.
It's great because it's basically, you start with a rough layout and then you draw the flash.
Yeah, there seems to be certain steps in between, like having talent that perhaps Carmine's not mentioning.
Yeah.
Don't try this if you don't have any talent. both of these stories are from 1967. I thought this was lesser than the Batman one. I liked the first one by Jim Shooter with art by Kurt Swan and George Klein. Whereas I didn't enjoy the second one as much. Yeah. I felt the art in the first one benefited more from the Treasury format than the second one.
It reminds me, I think this was something that we spoke about during the Happy Birthday of Superman, which is why I'm amazed that I remember this, but if I remember, we mentioned that Superman around this era was way more dated than Batman was.
Yes.
And I think this is a good example of it, is a lot of this is really fun and I really enjoyed it and the art's great and the stories are really fun. But if you were to say, oh, this was coming out at the same time that Batman was doing this, suddenly it seems a little more dated.
I think it's more the Marvel stuff than Batman.
Right.
Because the art in the second one, the story's by E. Nielsen Bridwell and the art's by Ross Andrew and Mike Esposito. Mm. Ross Andrew and Mike Esposito would go on to do Spider-Man and the art in that is much better than this.
Right, okay.
So I don't know what occurred here. I just think the first one holds up better. I think the first one's a more fun story. And I don't think the art holds up to Treasury format at all.
I think the first one's really fun because it is just played as a comedy, whereas the second one's played as a drama.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
But
enough.
Even in there, there's some great little bits, like Martian Manhunter's powers change depending on who he is. So he imitates Superman because Superman is invulnerable to fire. But then he tells the aliens this, and then the aliens go, well, obviously, we're going to utilise that now and imprison you some other way. Why would you tell us that, you idiot?
Yeah.
And
I love that he pointed it out to him.
Every other panel, Hal Jordan's like, oh, no, if only they weren't the colour yellow, I could have used my ring against them.
I love that he's allergic to the colour yellow. I really do. I honestly think that's a lesser one. I can see why people love it.
Yeah. I had a lot of fun with it. We covered those during the Happy Birthday Superman, didn't we?
The Races with the Flash?
Yeah.
I don't remember, because I haven't listened to that one yet.
Right.
I've listened to the 30s, 40s and 50s.
Because I knew that I had read those before, but not in Treasury form.
Right. I don't remember. Maybe we did. I don't know. Or maybe you just read them in what they are in the Superman versus the Flash trade.
Yeah, yeah.
So you just may have read that trade as a kid. Limited Collector's Edition C-59, Batman's Strangest Cases, reprints Red Water Crimson Death from The Brave and the Bold 93, Night of the Bat from Swamp Thing 7, The Batman Nobody Knows from Batman 250, and The Demon of Gotham's Mansion from Batman 227, and A Vow from the Grave from Detective Comics 410. This gets my pick as the best Batman one.
Mm.
But again, I wonder if this is my edge. Because this is smack dab in my wheelhouse. Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams, Len Wein, Bernie Wrightson, Giordano, Irv Novick, Frank Robbins, these were all the guys working on Batman, well, when I was reading reprints of Batman comics.
Well, I think this and the Ra's al Ghul one are my favourites. And I always think, you know, Batman's one of those characters who lends himself to literally any genre.
Yeah.
You pick any story whatsoever and pop Batman in it and he fits
it. And it worked.
But more so than anything else, I would argue more so than the crime noir roots, is Batman just really vibes with your gothic horror and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I read this over the last two nights just gone and loved it. Just reading it before bed, you know, in the dark, you got a little bedside table on. The stories aren't really that great. The Swamp Thing one I don't think works at all outside of the context of Swamp Thing, but just on the artwork alone,
yeah,
it's just an incredible read.
Yeah, the Redwater Crimson Death, Denny Neal, Neil Adams, it's a typical horror mystery of the era,
yeah,
like you mentioned. Nothing is really explained.
The contents page also says Batman's in Scotland, when there are several times it says, yeah, that he's in
Batman
Ireland.
Batman vacation in Scotland, but the story says he's in Ireland.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's because some Americans think Europe's one place.
And I loved it as a house of mystery story. It's narrated by Kane.
Yeah.
And it's not a Batman story as it is a House of Mystery story featuring Batman.
Well, that's when this was originally a Brave and the Bold. I'm like, but this was an issue of Batman, wasn't it?
Right,
but it isn't.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole thing, the whole House of Mystery vibe to it makes it a Brave and the Bold.
Right.
And that, you're right, it gives it a different feel.
Mm.
And because it's dealing with ghosts, Denny O'Neil doesn't feel the need to explain anything.
Yeah.
But that actually works for the story.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just becomes this atmospheric, if a little credulity stretching, entertaining little horror movie,
yeah,
with Batman in it.
Yeah.
If Neil Adams in the other trade was taking that 70s staple, the James Bond action movie, and putting Batman in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Here, he's taking the Hammer horror movie.
Yeah, definitely.
And putting Batman in it. And again, it works perfectly.
It's the strongest one,
yeah,
of the book, I think. And it just wraps it all up.
Yeah.
This story is what this treasury is, basically. This is the vibe of it. This,
yeah,
is the type of thing we're going for.
This isn't going to be your standard superhero action slugfest.
Yeah.
Or perhaps even a detective story.
Mm.
In this one, we're going for definitely that kind of Hammer horror gothic vibe.
Yeah.
That's what you're going to get in this treasury. And, yeah, I think that's why I like this one the best.
But then I think the complete opposite of that is when we get to this Swamp Thing one, which I had to look up, and it makes perfect sense that this comes from Swamp Thing issue 7.
Yeah.
Because there's no
Night of the Bat.
There's no context for anything. We're slap bang in the middle of a Swamp Thing story arc.
Which I didn't mind.
And, well, yeah. But the artwork is absolutely great in it.
Bernie Wrightson.
I didn't think that Bernie Wrightson would work on such a larger scale, but he really, really does. And I think what kind of pays it off is, I think the last panel is just Batman going, oh, I've no idea what was going on here, and maybe I never will. It's like, all right, okay, that's fair.
Well, yeah, I suppose so. I mean, there's a couple of standout moments in it. Yeah, the last panel is, maybe someday I'll take time to find out what's going on, but it's not going to be today.
No.
Obviously, the panel where Batman is stood watching over the pier with the cape swooping from behind.
Like him, going under his,
yeah,
legs.
The,
yeah,
the wind is blowing from behind him, so the cape's blowing through his legs and all that. Is an absolutely gorgeous image.
Mm.
The story is Swamp Thing arrives in Gotham on the trail of Abigail Arcane and Matt Cable, who've been kidnapped by the man who killed his wife, caused him to come Swamp Thing. Like Mike said, it's very definitely a Swamp Thing story with an appearance by Batman. It is another Len Wein story where he kills a dog.
Yeah.
There's more of them than you would imagine. And the minute that happens, you're like, okay, sorry, I do not give a rat's ass if Batman kills you.
Which is, he doesn't
this is
do.
The John Wick effect.
He doesn't kill him, he just doesn't save him.
Yeah, it's well, loads of people have problems with that in Batman Begins, didn't they?
Right, yeah,
he,
yeah,
he,
yeah.
He said, I'm not going to rescue you, but I'm not going to stop it, or whatever it is he,
yeah,
says. And you're like, but Batman does that all the time. Batman is quite willing to let a crook be killed in the course of being a crook.
Yeah.
And going, well, there are crocodiles.
Yeah.
You knew what was going to happen.
It's strangely one of those anti-hero things that works.
It works for Batman.
Yeah.
It's like, I didn't kill him,
yeah,
but I didn't really try and save him.
It's like Superman would save him,
yeah,
to teach him a lesson. Batman would go, well, you should have learned your lesson before.
Yeah, well, Batman would be, look, dude, if you weren't here committing this crime, you'd still be alive.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to lose any sleep over this.
Yeah. Batman would quite happily let a child put his hand in fire to learn a lesson.
To teach him. Yes. Again, there are crocodiles. The Batman Nobody Knows is a delightful little story whereby late night campfire tales tell what kids think is and isn't Batman. I absolutely love the guy who thinks he's Shaft. I love that kid.
It's weird reading this because I think that this is where Batwing came from.
Yeah.
Which I never clocked before. But
yeah.
This must, Batman must have its roots in this story.
Yeah, I love the Batman is Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, Shaft and Superfly.
I love the line where it's just like, what makes you think that Batman's a brother? What makes you think he isn't?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Can't argue with that. I absolutely love, I love this story.
I love that Bruce dresses up to be Batman to be like, maybe Batman looks like this. And they're all like, Bruce, what are you doing? Take the costume off. Grow up.
Grow up, man. After this chill told all these tall tales about Batman. The Demon of Gothos Mansion, Denny Neal of Novick and Dick Giordano. It's another spooky tale of ghosts and ghostly goings on. It's arguably more interesting than Crimson Death as a story.
Yeah.
But it could have done with a little bit more expansion. Some of the story beats in this move far too quickly.
Was this a backup? Because it
I think Demon of Gotham's Mansion led off. It's not a full 22-page story, though, is it? I don't think.
No, these next two, I think, are quite shorter, which made me think maybe they were backups.
Yeah, it's a 50. Well, maybe at this point, Batman had Robin in as a backup strip or Batgirl or whatever.
Right, okay.
Because there was a period where that happened. The ending's quite tragic.
Mm.
And again, this is one of those things, if Neil Adams had drawn it, this would be a classic.
But still, I think the artwork...
The artwork's fine.
...is really good, and it's... Yeah. I don't know if Neil Adams would have improved it at all. I really like it. And it's mostly heavy blacks, to be honest, and very limited colour.
Yeah, but again, it's horror. A vow from the grave. Neil Adams is back. Denny O'Neill does the story. Batman's helped on a stalking case by a group of travelling show freaks. I felt this was the lesser story in this collection.
And I think it's very... They have to over-explain what's going on because they don't actually do a particularly good job of showing you what's going on.
And they've not got the space. They've not got the page count.
Yeah.
The first one, Gothos Mansion, does benefit from being a 22-page story.
Mm.
And this suffers from being 13, 14, 15 pages, whatever it is.
Because I think there's one bit where there's a text box that just say, Batman has worked out the clues, have you?
Yeah.
No, because there aren't any.
Yeah, I think this one is a classic because it's got Neil Adams out.
Yeah.
I think if only Neil Adams had drawn Demon of Gothos Mansion, I think that would have been a much better story than it is. Not again, I'm nothing against Irv Novick. You're right, the artwork's fine.
Yeah.
But Neil Adams would have elevated it.
Right.
And I don't think Neil Adams could elevate this one. Because I don't think the story's as good as Gotham's Mansion.
See, that's the thing. I think the story of Gotham's Mansion is good and doesn't need elevating, whereas this one isn't as good, so Neil Adams does elevate it.
Which are both valid.
Yeah.
To be fair. So, yeah. Moon of the Wolf would have been a better choice, I think.
Okay,
for here, but I don't think that's only 15 pages.
I did love this little text piece at the back, that it's just like, if you liked these, here's a whole load more.
Here's a whole load more of horror, spooky... Gothic Tales. Mike W. Barr wrote that. Mike W. Barr's having for trouble with medical problems at the minute. I think he's doing a GoFundMe.
Right.
So if you are in a position to help, please do. That I think that one's better than the other Batman one. But again...
And this one, it's just great vibes.
Yeah.
Just read this with a nightlight and a cup of tea.
Yeah.
Perfect vibes.
Well, we've always loved Batman as gothic
horror
strip. And I don't know that they do that enough nowadays.
No.
They lean more into the crime noir of it, don't they? Next, in the first surprising move, DC then presented facsimiles of their original limited collector's editions, starting with the real holy grail of comic books, all new collector's edition C56, Spider-Man versus Muhammad Ali.
Spider-Man.
That doesn't last long, does it? Batman. No, Superman.
All three.
Batman, Spider-Man and Superman versus Muhammad Ali. We need to think of a punchline for that. Yeah. Written by Denny O'Neill with writing assistant art by Neil Adams. The variable deadline, Adam was basically told get it done whenever.
Right.
And there was something, I looked this up and then I can't remember it because I didn't write it down. It's something like Ali was champ. This was commissioned.
Right.
Ali got knocked out.
Right.
Was not champ.
Yeah.
But Adams took so long to do this that Ali became champ again. By the time it came out. Okay. I think that's the story. Now, one thing I did notice interesting about this was, because it took so long, Denny O'Neill has to bow out halfway through.
Right. And had he not already written the script?
No.
They were co-doing it.
Because he was only working on it as Adams gave him the pages.
They were marvelling it.
Yeah. Right. And Adams didn't have a deadline. He was told, do it, take as long as you want to do it. So he did. Until it eventually came out. Neil Adams takes over the script in halfway through. I noticed that, did you?
I didn't, but I knew because you'd already told me.
Yeah.
And I didn't quite feel it.
Did you not? See, my reading of this was, I'm reading the first half. I think Denny O'Neill's got his tongue in his cheek.
Yeah.
I think he's definitely writing this as a comedy. But then halfway through, Neil Adams comes in, and I think Neil Adams takes it far more seriously than Denny O'Neill was.
There are stakes and yeah. Like, okay.
I think O'Neill was writing it as a comedy, and Adams made it more serious.
I think he does a good enough job that it still feels like a natural progression of the story, though. It doesn't feel like two different things glued together.
Yeah. No, it doesn't. And it is great. Isn't it?
Yeah.
It's
Star
a lot
Wars
of fun.
Big when this came out?
Wasn't this just before Star Wars? Was this like 76 or something?
Because it feels...
I want to say.
It feels very much like it's riding off some kind of Star Wars hype.
Oh, so it came out in 78. So it was more that... Maybe it was commissioned in 76 and it took him 2 years to do it.
Right.
So it's... So whether or not the back half may have been influenced by Star Wars, because Neil may have seen that in the process of writing the book, I don't know. But it's coming out to coincide with Superman.
Yeah, right.
And that kind of works, doesn't it? I think this is gorgeous.
Great art.
Yeah.
And it's one of those where the art really does elevate it. Because if you stop and think about it, the story's insane. It is genuinely insane that they're just like, well, Superman's just going to fight this actual real life person.
Yeah.
Let's give it to the best artist that we've got. And it's Neil Adams that sells this because it's such an insanely preposterous concept that you need to sell it on the artwork.
And you've got the thing as well, though, that Ali's ego is all over this.
Oh, God, yeah.
So DC have got to work within the confines of working with a massive egotist and make him happy with every page.
Yeah.
I think he had final approval on an awful lot of the art.
But for them to be able to do this kind of cartoon alien romp, but still have it work as a commentary on the underdog and racial prejudices, it's more complex than it looks.
Than it needs to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've also got the thing as well, all the cartoony aliens, but Superman looks real.
Yeah.
And Ali looks real, and Jimmy looks real. And that's where Neil Adams sells this the best. That amidst all of the aliens and all the glitz and the glamour and the silliness of some of the story, he does weirdly keep it grounded.
Mm.
It's so good, Superman versus Muhammad Ali.
And it's one of those... I think I read all of this in one sitting, which is very rare for me.
Yeah, because that's how I noticed the difference in the tones.
Right, okay. Well, I think a lot of the other ones, for the most part, are either chapters or issues, whereas this is...
It's one big story,
This literally is a graphic novel.
Yeah.
But...
It starts and doesn't stop, doesn't it?
Yeah, so read it all in one go, and it's a summer blockbuster movie, and it's just one of those where it's so ludicrous and insane, but everything about it just works. And I think it's because it's so committed to itself. It doesn't look you in the eye and just give you a little wink to let you know that it knows it's being silly. It 100% sticks to its guns.
Yeah. They wouldn't make something like this nowadays.
No.
They wouldn't pull it off as well.
No.
I don't think. The cover is infamous.
Can you imagine? The Flash versus Lewis Hamilton.
Do you know I'd watch that? I think that would be a brilliant either episode or comic.
I do think the Flash could outrun an F1 car. Oh, you'd have to limit it, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you'd have to have the Flash limited in some way.
Right, yeah.
To see, you know, how it works. Johnny Storm is a race car driver.
Okay.
Everyone forgets that about Johnny Storm.
Okay.
But back in the early days, he was an incredibly gifted mechanic.
Right.
And he built his own race cars.
Okay.
And there are issues where he's on the race car circuit.
Okay.
And I think they kind of touch on it in one of the Chris Evans movies.
Right.
So the Human Torch versus Lewis Hamilton.
Right.
And obviously something happens and he has to turn into... Yeah. So all of that would work, The Flash would be the Flash versus Usain Bolt, right?
Okay, right.
That would totally work.
Yeah.
As well. And you know.
We need to bring back superheroes versus real people.
Can we have Superman versus Conor McGregor and have Superman punch his head off?
I mean, that's just one page, isn't it?
Yeah, but what a page. Superman versus Wonder Woman, all new collector's edition C-54. This is the one we mentioned earlier. We did know that it was coming out, but we didn't see the solicit.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and bought Into Forbidden Planet and Choirs of Angels, and I got you it for Christmas.
Yes.
Because you didn't have it, so I found a copy for you. This was written by Jerry Conway with art by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Superman the movie was out, and Wonder Woman was on the small screen.
Okay.
So that's probably why this happened. Right. For the same reason that it was Batman versus the Hulk, which doesn't make a lick of sense.
Okay.
But Batman's on telly and the Hulk's on telly.
Right. Got it. Okay.
So in this, Superman's on telly. Well, he's on the big screen. Wonder Woman's on telly.
Okay.
Let's put Christopher Reeve against Linda Carter.
Right.
And that would have been better than this.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of this one at all. Mm. I don't like superheroes in World War II. We're not going to go into it. But this simplistic story just does not change my mind.
I think this is what I was saying about Superman versus Muhammad Ali, where it sticks to its convictions and uh-huh. that's what sells it. This doesn't.
No, this doesn't. The cowardly opening yeah. of Superman taking on the Japanese fighters, but the Japanese fighters being drones.
It's drones that Superman says must be expensive when we all know historically that Japan was really, really poor in the war,
yeah.
so had to reuse and, old models.
And that's why I just can't get behind it. On the one hand, this is cowardly.
Yeah.
Let's not deal with any moral ambiguity of having Superman decide he's going to fight for the Allies, so that may actually involve him killing people.
Yeah.
Because that would be good and interesting. We can't have any of that in this story. But the technology that's depicted in these comics changes World War II.
So if you're going to have it set during that time and be historically yeah. accurate with them talking to actual real people.
Yeah, which this does.
Yeah.
So I dislike all of that. I dislike Superman being involved just generally. Wonder Woman goes through this entire thing seemingly thinking World War II is America versus Germany.
Mm.
That's it.
Yeah.
No one else gets a mention. Wonder Woman's pious view of atomic weapons, which fluctuates throughout the story, is really irritating. So I said, all right, well, let's take all that off the table.
Yeah.
Does it just work as like a Kelly's Heroes style romp, a Force 10 from Navarone, that kind of thing? Not yeah. a serious World War II picture, but, you know, a bit of fluff and a bit of fun. Clint Eastwood, you know, snarling his way through his dialogue, Telly Savalas, that kind of thing.
Right.
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. And I was reading it as a romp. I'm thoroughly enjoying this for the first half. It's over the top, silly little romp. The artwork is great. And
yeah, the artwork's really, lovely. No fault
really
with the artwork.
Works well on this tabloid size. And then it gets to a point where Wonder Woman goes, man is going to use an atomic missile. I disagree with it, so I'm going to cause a fight. Could have been potentially interesting depiction of how do superheroes see Holocaust capable weapons.
Mm-hmm.
That could be quite interesting. But it's when Superman, who represents America,
yep.
fights Wonder Woman going, no, you're wrong, and I'm going to beat the out of you for being wrong. And then instead of kind of explaining or being written in character, I think, because he's grossly out of character in this, Superman then goes, well, okay, I don't want to hurt anyone around us, so let's go fight on the moon. Because
yeah,
we can't,
that was dumb.
We can't have a conversation, you know, we can't have a debate and discuss the pros and cons. Let's go fight on the moon. So they do go fight on the moon. Wonder Woman points out the rubble of an ancient city that was destroyed by a nuclear holocaust. We don't linger on that. It doesn't serve to be some kind of meaningful parallel to the issues that are happening in the present day. And then they come back down, beat the bad guys, and Superman still goes, well, you're still wrong, and at some point I am going to beat you up until you realise how wrong you are. It's awful. It's genuinely awful. And the implications of that as well, I think, are really kind of unsettling for someone with Superman's power and the ability to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, to just go, okay, so yeah, America's going to build this nuclear bomb and they're going to drop it on a country and I'm perfectly fine with that and that needs to happen, Wonder Woman.
Mm.
It's wrong. It's regardless of your views on it, for Superman to just say, no, Wonder Woman, this needs to happen, felt incredibly out of character and forced to not quite commit to the story that it wants to tell.
Yeah, Superman can't kill the Japanese pilots at the beginning. It has to be robots, but they're perfectly fine with him dropping a nuclear bomb on people.
Yeah, it's all over the place.
It can't be a serious look at World War II because
no.
it's got people like this guy in it, this samurai dude.
The one Japanese dude called Sumo, who's also a samurai.
And this guy, Baron Blitzkrieg in the Nazi yellow.
Yeah.
Although you can't do it. It
yeah.
cannot in any way be a serious look at World War II
yeah.
when it's got these ludicrous characters running around in it. So it doesn't work as a romp. But then Jerry Conway seems to think he's making important statements about atomic weapons.
Yeah.
But the dialogue's comic book bad.
But every time there is the implication of a statement. They yeah. don't. They don't commit to it.
They don't commit to it.
Every single possible thing about this is cowardly, and it's like Conway is potentially implying that America weren't doing the right thing for the right reasons, but doesn't want to commit to that because that would be a black and white viewpoint that he doesn't want to take with a superhero comic.
But ironically, in dealing with superheroes in this manner, that is just a black and white take.
And so what then happens is Superman and Wonder Woman are single-handedly responsible for the first nuclear bomb being yeah. launched. But it's a superhero fight, and the implications of that aren't followed up on, because you can't follow up with any implications because that didn't happen in real life. But this comic wants to be about what happened in real life.
Yeah.
Insane for all the wrong reasons.
Yes, I was deeply disappointed in this. I have been disappointed in it every time I've read it. It doesn't help that the characters come across as assholes.
Yeah, it pales in comparison to other examples of superheroes being wars. New Frontier.
Yeah.
What Darwin Cook does with Wonder Woman and Superman in Vietnam.
Yeah.
100 times better than that. And again,
he has the benefit of, well, I was just going to say he's got the benefit of hindsight, but it's not like Jerry Conway yeah. wrote that in World War II, is it?
Again, there's no clear-cut right or wrong. It lingers these little questions in front of you, and you as the reader have to decide. And the characters, they live their own world, mm-hmm. and it's way better than that.
All new collector's edition C-58 Superman vs. Captain Marvel, written by Jerry Conway, with that by Rich Buckler and Dick Giordano, is forthcoming.
Yeah, I think
so. We don't have that
this
one.
Month.
But I've not covered it in this because we're only talking about these yeah. facsimiles, these that are available. However, as welcome as these were, nothing would prepare you for what happened next. DC produced a facsimile edition of a treasury that never existed. Limited edition, The Untold Legend of the Batman, was just solicited as a standard comic written by Len Wein, art by Jim Aparo and John Byrne. Nowhere was it mentioned.
Yeah.
That this was treasury size.
Just a 3-in-1.
Yeah. So when it was solicited as having a foil variant cover, people, well, a lot of facsimiles have those, didn't think anything of it. Imagine our surprise and delight when this was released to find it was in the treasury format.
Yeah.
This opens the floodgates, man. If DC is open to making new treasury editions, mm-hmm. albeit with older material,
right,
then nothing is off the table.
As
remember that.
Oh, okay. Okay, right.
I have had to rewrite the ending to this show so many times because of, oh, that's happened.
Yeah.
Anyway, The Untold Legends of the Batman was the first real miniseries. It was released as three separate comics. John Byrne was supposed to draw all three issues because he only had 3 months to do the job before his other work obligations kicked in. But the scripts were so late, he only had time to do issue one. Byrne has also stated Terry Austin was to have inked this.
Right.
And as good as Aparo was, can we all take a moment and think about what could have been? X-Men era John Byrne, X-Men era Terry Austin,
yeah,
doing this three-issue Batman, now published at treasury size. I mean, they kind of known that back then, but come on.
Hindsight is 2020.
It's a wonderful gift. Of this reprint on a post on his forum in January 2025, Byrne said, oh, not square bound, so not really a treasury edition. And the pedantry award goes to... Anyway, DC Comics had 3 covers to choose from for the 3 single issues, and they picked the wrong one. That is easily the worst cover. Isn't it? And Batman leaping on the Batmobile, Robin driving it away.
It's not bad by any means.
No.
Of the three.
But yeah, that's my point. It is not in any way a bad cover. Michael is 100% correct. But of the three covers, the first one and the third one are much better.
But it's the third one that was solicited.
Was it?
Yeah.
Right.
Because the third one is also the cover for the
little
trade.
Little trade paperback. Yeah. Okay, all right. Yeah, well, whatever. They chose the wrong one, but it doesn't matter. The basic plot sees Batman receive a package from a mysterious someone with his father's bat costume inside. It was stolen from inside the cave and inside a special case with a note taped inside. All of this points to an inside job. Batman recounts his origins to Alfred as well as considering all his friends and foes until it's revealed Batman has been doing this to himself. You do, and that's what really hurts. Following a concussion he received on a recent case.
Yeah.
There is lots of lovely Golden and Silver Age nuttiness to this story. Thomas Wayne dresses as a bat, captures a criminal, turns him over to Gordon, and Gordon has never put these dots together.
It's good. I liked that because when I was reading this, I was reminded a lot of Grant Morrison's Batman run.
Yeah.
As we mentioned in the past, Morrison is very much of the idea that everything happened, regardless of timelines and reboots. Everything that happened, happened.
Yeah.
And so much of that run stems from this, including his dad's costume. And it was really fun to read this and see the parallels and where a lot of elements of that run came from.
Mm.
So it was really nice and refreshing to read this, because it's like you finally kind of peeking behind the curtain to go, oh, that's where it came from, kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, this was the first time they'd made an effort to try and knit all the disparate continuity
into 5 years
of the Golden Silver Age into one streamlined whole.
Yeah.
And even though I think he kind of downplays some things and ignores others.
Yeah.
But for the most part, this was the first time they'd really tried to do this. Because, for example, Lou Moxon arranging the Wayne's death's a retcon.
Mm.
But I'm sure if they were all put together in this way before this, Joe Chill still ends up being the murderer.
Yeah.
So they're not really changing anything. The main differences, I think, is Bruce has a living relative named Uncle Philip, who took in Bruce after his parents' death.
Yeah.
And Philip's housekeeper, Mrs. Chilton, helps Bruce get over the deaths. In true comic soap opera telling, Mrs. Chilton turns out to be Joe Chill's mum.
Right.
And
yeah,
Bruce
yeah.
doesn't know this, but Alfred does.
Yeah. Because I didn't know that, but I remembered her because she's referenced in the Morrison run.
Right.
Which is one of those things that's kind of interesting going back to this is, in the next reboot, what made the cut kind of thing? Because this is pre-crisis.
Yeah, this is 1980.
So kind of seeing all of those little things that were retroactively added into this timeline that were then retroactively left out in the next timeline.
Yeah.
It's one of those interesting things just to see what and who made the cut.
Yeah, what gets edited as time moves on.
I liked and disliked that Batman was the original Robin.
I think that's silly.
It's silly.
But it doesn't matter.
And it's cute, but it's a bit too cute.
Yeah, because surely working with a detective, worry that
yeah
attracts an awful lot of attention to a man who, let's be honest,
doesn't want to attract attention.
Yeah. It's not so much that Robin or Bruce likes wearing the colourful costume, it's more that Harvey would be like, dude,
yeah,
we're supposed to remain inconspicuous.
Literally.
This is like being a detective and driving a massive Ford that's red with a white stripe down the side of it. Knock this off.
But it's really funny as well, though, because he's inspired by his dad's bat costume. Now, this
yes.
costume is sleek and all black. So he decides to wear tighty greenies with a bright red vest and bright yellow cape and little Robin Hood elf boots. Like, what?
I know, but whatever.
Like,
it was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. The great character moment in this one is Bruce in criminology class learning the difference between justice and the law.
Yeah.
That was a great moment. And if we ever get a proper Marvel DC Batman Daredevil crossover, I'd love you to establish Matt Murdock was in this class with Bruce Wayne. Because
yeah.
I think that'd be really cool.
Yeah.
I love the paper stock. Again, look at that splash page of Batman punching the Joker with all of the criminals in the background and Robin behind him for that old gag of shoving him over so he falls.
I don't remember when Batman ever fought Ghost Rider.
Oh, who is that? I know who that is and I've forgotten it.
Right.
Because underneath him's the Gentleman Ghost.
Yeah.
And then there's various other people, some of which I know, some of which I don't know. There's Jervis Tetch and Clayface and so on and so forth. Robin's... the Joe Chill stuff is directly from the 1940 origin.
Right.
And him having a heart, getting gunned down by people too stupid to realise.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, we know somebody who knows Batman's identity.
But I like the irony that you
yeah.
made Batman.
So we're going to kill you
yeah.
for making Batman, but then you could tell us who Batman is. It's, you know, that's straight from the original story. Len Wein's not playing around or anything there.
Right.
I love that we get some proper Jim Aparo's Batman smacking someone around because his punches feel hard.
Yeah, yeah.
Jim Aparo's punches always felt like, I don't want to be on the wrong side of that.
I think now that we're into Aparo's pencils, I think I'd have preferred to just have Aparo all the way through.
Well, that's why he inked issue one.
Right.
To make it have more continuity. Yeah, if we were going to get this, I'd rather have had Aparo do it. I mean, I'd rather have had Byrne and Austin do it.
Okay.
All of it.
I'd have rather have had Aparo. I just...
Jim Aparo doing it would be more in keeping with the bat books of the time.
Yeah.
Yes. But it would have been nice to see John Byrne and Terry Austin at the peak of their powers.
See, I just think I prefer Byrne to be over at Marvel. I've never been as big of a fan of his DC stuff as his Marvel stuff.
Well, it's interesting that, isn't it? That you associate some creators with a specific company. Yeah. And you're right. I do think of Byrne as Marvel. And Jim Aparo is DC. I don't think I've ever seen Jim Aparo draw anything for Marvel.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. Robin's origins are all pretty much straight from the originals.
Yeah.
The stuff about him being a poodle for the rich or having to ignore bullies, that seems new or influenced by Marvel.
Yeah.
I don't remember that being a thing originally, but yeah. I haven't read every Batman story from the 40s and the 50s, so I don't know.
What I did really like about these first two issues, more so than anything else, I think the third one does it a little bit, is all three issues take place at the same time, roughly, but this is from Batman's perspective, this is from Robin's perspective, I think is the third one from Gordon's perspective.
Yes.
So it's really good because you jump through time quite a lot, but from different point of views, which is one of those things that you only really do with a good amount of foreplanning. Like, these don't feel like three individual issues. These all feel like a one thing, really.
So maybe that's why it took Len Wein so long to actually get the scripts out, because he was doing that. It seems weird now to remember that for 40 years, Alfred wasn't there from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
Wein streamlines Alfred's origins, ignoring Alfred Beagle. None of that's in it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
who I only know because of Zero Hour.
Yeah, so he ignores all of that. But it's amazing to me, that one panel of Alfred doing his best in World War II.
Yeah.
Can I have that as a treasure? Alfred in World War II. That inspired a Pennyworth TV show. The origin of Alfred. The origin of Batman's butler.
That's what it's actually called as well, isn't it?
At Pennyworth, the origin of Batman's butler.
Because that's... I mean...
It's a TV show of him just going to butler school. And showing him how to polish forks.
Right, okay.
It's literally the show. It is like Bridgerton.
Right.
It's one of those type shows.
You know what? That sounds like it could weirdly work. Yeah.
The only connection it's got is there's a guy in it called Alfred Pennyworth. In every other respect, it's just Downton Abbey or something like that.
It's some kind of Downton Abbey-esque, like a modern Downton Abbey-esque show, but every once in a while, you'll just see the Batmobile drive through, or you'll just...
He's just learning to be...
Oh, right.
Okay. He is. Batman's not in it.
Right. Well, I think you could do it now. The day-to-day life of Alfred. And Batman's there, but he's in the background. Like, you might...
It's Alfred going to Little Fates and eating Little Finger sandwiches and just generally being upper-class man about town.
Yeah. Like, imagine an Alfred Pennyworth keeping up appearances and he's got to go out of his way to cover up Bruce Wayne's secret identity from the neighbours.
So there's lots of misunderstandings, you're saying, and lots of miscommunication that leads to comedy hijinks.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow. I think you've just made a show that'll run for 10 seasons.
It definitely will.
Oh, God. It's interesting to look back as well and see that Barbara Gordon's crush is on Bruce, not Dick.
It was weird reading this, and I'm not sure what I thought about it. In this, Commissioner Gordon knows about
that Barbara's Batgirl,
being Batgirl. Yeah. And that, I think, was a retcon that didn't vibe with me, because I've never liked that. I've always liked the secret. That's the only way that kind of works. So yeah, it just felt weird that he's like, oh yes, and now she just fights crime with Batman. Like, no, how are you okay with this?
Yeah, how are you fine with this, and how are you fine with him endangering a kid?
Yeah,
and all of that. What did you think of a stuntman's the guy who builds the Batmobile?
Loved it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Wasn't that an episode of the animated series as
probably,
well?
Probably, yeah. And it's one of those weird things, but just like, I guess so, yeah. But why would Batman know how to build a car?
Yeah, so every time they blow the Batmobile up, they've got to get in touch with this guy and say, can you afford to build us a new Batmobile?
But it's weird as why he has bespoke Batmobiles and not just a Ford Mustang with wings on it.
It does make kind of sense that someone builds this for him.
Just kind of like Robin phones, just because we need a new Batmobile, and he looks around his garage and he's like, charger okay?
And he phones him and says, I need a new Batmobile, and he's like, again? Dude, come on. I mean, I presume Bruce sends him a check.
Yeah, well, no, he says he does it for free, doesn't he? Because he owes Batman a favour.
But he has to buy the parts, man.
Yeah.
Just building it and designing it, okay, he does that as a favour.
Yeah.
But the actual buying of the bits that he needs, surely.
Yeah.
Bruce is subbing him some money for that.
Still in this as well, isn't it? That he's the Batcave is next to a train station.
Yeah.
Which I love, and that just gets forgotten about post-Nightfall.
Yes, no, because in Nightfall they do have Bat-Train, because we did that old thing about we're on the Bat-Train to Gotham.
Yeah.
It's the Bat-Train to Gotham, and I'll meet you at the station. But yeah, so it is a bit weird. One of the things about this, I love all these old expository dialogue bits.
Mm.
As you know, and now I'm going to tell you exactly things that you know, but the audience needs to know.
Yeah.
And because I'm a hack writer, this is the only way I'm going to get it out of the way. And I love that. This page here is exactly there. Well, as you know, I build your Batmobiles because Batman did me a favour once and I'm a stuntman. It's like this entire page is just this stunt guy who I'd never heard of him.
Me neither.
I did not remember this. If this guy comes from the Golden or the Silver Age, I was not aware of this story.
Yeah.
I bet there's an 8-page story in 1946 or something.
Right.
The man who builds Batman's Batmobiles and he's never mentioned again.
Oh, probably... more realistic than that is just Batman just saves the guy in one panel and we move on.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where you just kind of go back and just gleb shit at him a little bit. Oh, he's got a Wikipedia page now. He's an actual person. That guy, you know, running with the little ice cream maker prop, those were actually the rebel plans.
Yeah, you're absolutely... This is the kind of thing they're digging into now to make all of the interminable Star Wars stories. But it's why year one was necessary, isn't it?
Mm.
There's a lot of these little things that have been bolted on over the years. Well, where does he get his Batmobile from? Well, this stuntman builds them for him.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
I think I like it, but I see why they got rid to streamline.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of makes more sense that Alfred's a good mechanic. If you've established it in World War II, essentially that's what he did.
Yeah.
He was a mechanic in World War II who also helped the French.
Yeah.
He was heavy with the French resistance, wasn't he? So all that stuff's quite interesting. And this was all canon in 1980.
Mm.
So when this was written, this was Len Wein doing his best to make it all work as a cohesive whole.
It's such a shame that he did this. And this must have been quite a hefty challenge to do.
And in three issues.
But then 5 years later, none of it matters anyway.
Yeah, the crisis happens and it all gets worse, isn't it? And 2 pages, Batgirl, done.
Yeah.
2 pages of expository dialogue and Batgirl's gone.
Just going down a little checklist of things that we need to mention.
Yeah. Issues that this cribbed from. I did some research here.
Okay.
Detective Comics 33, 38, 66, 168, 226, 235, 359 and 457. And Batman 16, 47 and 217. What was interesting to me about that was how much of this came from Detective Comics, which traditionally nowadays does not sell as well as Batman.
Okay, right.
And very little of it actually came from Batman.
Well, was Detective the equivalent of Amazing and Batman was the equivalent of Spectacular?
I think it was more Detective Comics and Action Comics sold better because there was a more generic flavour to them. They knew they were going to get a Superman-Batman story in it.
Okay.
And what else came along with it? I don't know. I honestly don't know.
I think the issue with this as a kind of story, though, is... It feels like it perfectly does what it set out to do of kind of tying everything together. It just falls apart as an actual story in and of itself, though.
Because it's a continuity exercise.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Just the reveal that the mastermind was Batman himself. He'd just forgotten about it. Felt a little bit like a cop-out.
It felt like what it was, that he needed a narrative hook to string all his recollections together.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like. I thoroughly enjoyed it. For me, this was a trip down memory lane.
Yeah.
Because at this point, I've kind of forgotten that all of this, if I even ever knew, in the case of Stuntman Mike, Stuntman Jack, really, wasn't he? I didn't even know he was a part of this.
Mm.
That there was once a guy who built his Batmobiles.
Yeah.
And Alfred has now been there from the beginning longer than he wasn't. So my age and up, really... You came in with year one, which was 86, when I was, 12 or 13?
So year one was the post-crisis origin.
Yeah. So if you came in there, you've still been reading comics now for 40-plus years.
Mm.
You may never have known any of this. This was not your continuity.
And what I really enjoyed...
Certainly for you, this wasn't.
Well, what I really enjoyed about this was with this feeling like this is where a lot of the Morrison stuff came from, this was more like walking down a proxy memory lane, I guess.
Yeah.
Of a Batman who no longer exists.
Yeah.
None of this exists. This is a snapshot. This is like a modern day... quotations, modern day snapshot of something that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. And for that alone, it was nice to see it as a treasurer.
Yeah.
And it was nice to revisit this prior incarnation of Batman that no longer exists.
Yeah. Now, I did some research.
Did you?
Now that we've moved on to the Secrets of the Batman.
Oh, yeah. Up. The treasury has added value. Secrets of the Batman covers the cave now under Wayne Enterprises. No mention is made of this being a different cave to the one under the manor.
Yeah. But this, okay, so this is the extent of my research.
Okay.
This series got republished as an audio drama with cassettes that came with the comics.
So it did, yeah.
These backups are from the reprint that came with the cassettes, not the original comics.
That's, I did not know that. And I've got the original comics.
Right, okay.
I just didn't bother digging them out.
So as far, I mean, I could be wrong. This is just what I've read online, but these backups are not in the originals. These backups came from the audio drama reprints.
That's actually quite, that's very interesting. And I applaud you bringing your A game.
I try sometimes.
I love that the cave exit here is into an alley. Finger alley.
Isn't that where teenagers go?
No, that's drug-addled alley. ketamine alley, apparently. Finger alley, sorry, is an empty warehouse owned by Bruce Wayne that leads to an alley at the side.
Right.
Isn't that kind of like Bruce Wayne owns this, Bruce Wayne owns this, and the Batmobile comes down this road quite a lot?
Yeah, well, yeah.
I mean, CCTV wasn't that big a deal, I guess.
Maybe no one wants to say, oh, Bruce Wayne's been spotted around Finger Alley. It's like, oh yeah, I saw him up Bum Road Alley the other day as well.
Oh, no. No, nobody wants that.
I just spotted Bruce Wayne in Doggin Park.
Is Doggin Park a new villain? that said, all of that we just mentioned, the boat and the plane are linked via tunnels to Wayne Enterprises.
Yeah.
So again, the boat and the plane are linked to Wayne Enterprises.
As we have learned, though, Bruce Wayne could stand on TV in a Batman costume and say, I am Batman, and no one would believe him.
Well, yeah, that's very true. But if you look, the plane...
is taken out from the building, yeah.
Yeah, so that building must be empty, right? That's just a hollow shell for the plane to be in. It's only 3 stories high. Yeah. That's not a long way from the ground for somebody to go, wait a minute, where's that plane coming from?
Well, maybe it's on the bad side of town. I mean, it is next to Finger Alley, you know.
It can't be on the bad side of town. Bruce owns... Well, all right, maybe he owns the bad side of town. I don't know.
Well, maybe that's... You know, Bruce Wayne is quite hospitable. He's put a lot of his wealth into buying up houses for the poor. So what if one of them is just an empty facade where he stores his Harrier?
Do you think he ever has to answer questions from the press? He bought that derelict building. Are you ever going to do anything with it? Yeah. And he's kind of like, maybe one day. So there's a River Thames, runs through Gotham directly from.
Is convenient because you know that's where the boat comes.
I did not know that Gotham had a River Thames.
Right.
So that was new to me as well. The he's updated his utility belt.
Yeah.
From the last time we saw the utility belt, so I found that was quite good. There's an old Ask the Answer Man page.
Yeah.
I don't know where that came from. I don't know whether that was in the issues that this was originally in, but it's quite interesting that
I liked
they've done
how
that.
Cut the bullshit the answers are.
Oh, yeah.
They're very straight to the point.
Yeah, this was, Bob Razakis was the answer man? Oh, yeah, his answers were always, action 239. That was it.
Yeah.
There was never any elaboration on that. What issue did Superman have polka dot underpants? Superman 334.
Is that true?
I don't know. I made that up. I mean, I would imagine if he wanted polka dot underpants, it would have been in an issue somewhere. That's all fun. There's a cover gallery, as we've mentioned. The two best covers did not get picked as the cover, but whatever. And there's adverts for Superman versus Muhammad Ali again. And the untold epic of World War II. We'll be the judge of that. Superman versus Wonder Woman. This has also been printed as a monochromatic paperback. as Michael mentioned, an audio adaptation and a breakfast cereal giveaway.
Wow. That's so cool. So you used to be able to get comics in your cereal.
Apparently so,
and now you
yes.
can't even get comics in comic shops.
Yeah. The... Ooh, punchy satire. I do remember the Colin Baker Doctor Who comics were given away in a cereal box.
Right, okay.
Yeah, from the Marvel stuff.
That's so cool.
Yeah, and some of them were Grant Morrison stories.
Right.
I'm sure Grant Morrison wrote one of them with Frobisher the Penguin. I'm sure he wrote some of that. Right. But the surprises keep coming, which is the reason I've had to keep rewriting this ending.
Yeah, yeah.
DC announced the most anticipated comic book sequel of all time.
Of all time.
Hush 2, which its first issue is already out.
These don't count.
And I've read. They're presented as a facsimile Treasury edition, but even bigger. Why do they not count?
Because they're not Treasury editions. They are
artist editions.
They've got another name because they're not even that either.
I've seen one in a shop,
right?
But I wasn't inclined to buy it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be brutally honest. I don't think Jim Lee's artwork is that good now to warrant such a larger scale. X-Men era, original Hush era, absolutely. But modern Jim Lee, I can't see his artwork looking any better on a larger than Treasury size.
And there must be an audience for it.
Collectors, yeah. Resellers,
slabbers.
Yeah.
I enjoyed Hush 2 issue 1. Right. I haven't read any more yet, as okay. we record this.
So we can all go downhill.
It possibly will. DC followed this up with an all-new Treasury edition.
Yes.
More than 25 years after DC's last new Treasury, which was a Superman Fantastic Four team-up.
Right, okay.
By Dan Jurgens.
The Treasury klaxon went off. We dusted it off.
The Treasury
klaxon. We checked the batteries and they were still going.
Well, they leaked a bit. We had to do some polishing. Superman Treasury 2025, Hero for All, mm-hmm. written by Dan Jurgens, illustrated by Bruno Redondo, colour by Adriana Lucas, will be released on July 2nd as part of DC Comics Summer of Superman 2025.
Is there a film coming out?
Designed to tie in, funnily enough, with a film called Superman. It's an original title.
Dan Jurgens doing a Superman Treasury. Yeah. It's like we never left the 90s.
I think that's great. Are you excited for that? I'm ordering that.
I'm ordering it,
yeah.
Obviously, because if I don't, then my collection will not be complete. I can't say I'm excited for it.
Why?
I don't know.
It's
new. We don't like new things.
Oh, right. Okay.
No, I think it's more a case of like, the joy of the Treasuries as they are facsimiles of, you know, these
older comics.
So there's a joy to that. I'm a bit more, I'm going to get it regardless, but I'm a little more dubious with new, brand new.
Can you recapture what made them great?
And I think, as we've learned from the Untold Tales of Batman, is there's an excitement of republishing facsimiles as Treasuries, as brand new Treasuries. It's a little more... Something
yeah, that was still new. Something from 1980.
So something that is brand new, intentionally a Treasury. What's it gonna be like? Could go wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, right. The best thing to do is for just them to play it safe and just do a nice little Superman story in Treasury size.
Well, you know what I would have liked them to do? Superman the movie Treasury.
Okay.
For 2025 Superman.
Right.
In exactly the same format as the Superman the movie Treasury from 1978.
There's just pictures of the
film
or something.
Yeah, just film stills and articles about the film and stuff. I would have loved them to have done that. And the cover be this new guy.
Yeah.
In exactly the same pose as Christopher Reeve is on the cover of...
Right, okay.
I think that would have been a fantastic thing to do. And essentially, it's a brand new Treasury, but it's all about the new film.
Right, yeah.
I think that would have been great. I'd have been there for that.
Yeah.
But, and, you know.
I just hope they keep doing them.
Yeah.
I will buy the Rudolph Treasury. They're just...
A reprint of Rudolph.
They're just gold. And I'm getting to the point now where there's this saturation of the actual facsimiles, but the Treasuries just keep being gold.
Like, yes.
They can do all of those. I'll buy them all.
Yep. And there's a finite amount as well. Do you think Marvel will start doing them?
Well,
there's clearly money to be made.
So, I mean, to add on to the ending...
Mm.
To make this episode have
even longer.
more endings than The Return of the King. what was also announced, but to mixed response, and by that I mean...
Me us, and you.
Marvel announcing Lo This Monster, which we were both excited for,
yep.
but the more details, the less excited we are.
Yeah, originally this was announced as being a Treasury edition of Spectacular Spider Magazine 1 and 2. One was black and white.
Yeah.
Two was colour.
Yeah.
And if this was a treasury, we were both quite excited about it.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's not. It's one of those Marvel square-bound paperback treasuries that if you've got Fantastic Four Antithesis or the representation of Captain America Bicentennial Battles, which was a treasury,
right,
it's in that format. And it's also double the price of the DC ones.
Yeah.
And the minute that I learned that, I was like, scratch that off, not ordering that.
But it does beg the question, and this is really exciting if this does get the case. Marvel and DC set aside their differences. Mm-hmm. They re-released their crossovers in the two big omnibuses.
Yeah.
They've just announced that there's going to be another DC-Marvel crossover.
Mm-hmm. They've not told us what that is yet, have they?
No, but are we going to get
Superman, Spider-Man.
The facsimile treasuries of those crossovers, because that will be exciting.
Yeah, Superman, Spider-Man 1 and 2, Batman, Hulk, and in a perfect world, and the precedent has now been set, X-Men, Teen Titans as a treasury for the first time.
Right.
And there's other people have pointed out on like forums and stuff that there was a Justice League story that was chopped up into three comic books that was originally written and designed and presented and drawn to be a treasury. Right. And it was cancelled at the last minute.
Okay, right.
Put that out as a treasury final.
Yeah.
And I kind of think, all right, I'd be there for that.
Because the DC have very much opened the floodgates now.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of people bathing in the waters while these floodgates are pouring on them. It'd be a shame to close them.
Yeah, it would be.
So it can only be exciting if they continue to literally take our money.
Yeah.
These treasuries, we're throwing money at them. It would be stupid for them to not do it.
And this may say something about the state of the modern comic book industry.
Yeah.
Which I'm not down on. I think DC are doing some really good stuff at the minute. Marvel, not so much. But DC are doing some interesting things. And the independents are doing some interesting things.
Yeah.
But I get more excited when I see that a treasury edition has been facsimiled.
Yeah.
And every month, my first inclination is to look, what are the facsimiles this month?
Yeah.
And do I want them?
It's just, there's just a joy to them.
Yeah, it's just bliss.
I can't put my finger on it, but the facsimiles, and especially the treasuries, are just,
They're delightful.
They are always a definite purchase.
Yeah, me and Al. I mean, even treasuries I've got, like you said, I bought the Ra's al Ghul one because the cover's come off mine.
Yeah.
So I wanted one where that hasn't. I was a bit disappointed in the cover, but it's the only disappointment really with the treasury so far. Every single one of them has been joy.
Mm.
Next time, an all new episode of Fake Kids Comics. Speaking of Superman.
Yes.
Next week, we're all in on tying in.
Yes, yes.
With the new movie, with a look at Superman, the Man of Steel from 1986. That's a re-review, because we have looked at it before. Superman Smashes the Klan from 2020, and Superman Adventures 41 from 2000, with diversions into other little strips that we've considered covered but don't want to devote a full show to.
I'm going
to
say, I just read all of the Space Age to catch up, thinking that we were going to do it, and now we're not even doing it.
Yeah. Well, I've not reread it yet. We may do.
Okay.
I may add that to the show, but we'll see. So we'll see you next time for that. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Hey Kids Comics is a The Devil Will Make Work for Idle Hands to Do production and hosted by Andrew and Michael Leyland. All opinions expressed in the show are the opinions of the hosts and no one else. The free-to-use music that closes and opens the show was the sci-fi cyberpunk trailer by somebody called Stringer Bell on the Pixabay.com free-to-use website. Thank you very much to them. Every single episode of the show going all the way back to the beginning in 2010 is available on archive.org at the address archive.org/details/@APLUK, where you can fill your boots on over 15 years of classic episodes. If you would like to support the show, you can buy Michael and I, or both of us, or one of us, a coffee. Go to ko-fi.com, that's ko-fi.com/aleyland. In 1 month, an all-new episode of Hey Kids Comics, coming in your ears. It's a date.